Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and practiced on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. High Truths is more than a podcast. It's a movement to unite physical, mental, and addiction health. It brings innovations to connect public health, public safety, and prevention. Our discussions inspire people to implement programs that save lives. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a 5-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com. Today's episode is sponsored by Drug Free America Foundation, tackling the pervasive issue of substance use and its far-reaching impacts on individuals, families, and community. Drug Free America is supporting ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, doctors and scientists educating on the harms of marijuana. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a pediatric fentanyl poisoning conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Pediatric fentanyl poisoning, as in children and babies who are killed by fentanyl or exposed to fentanyl. These babies and children do not have an opiate use disorder. They are not addicted. They are victims of a crime. At the end of 2020, I first learned about a 10-month-old who was living with her grandparents, crawling on the ground and suddenly became unresponsive. 911 was called and EMS started CPR. They continued pushing on this little baby's chest for 45 minutes, and only later a urine drug screen was found to be positive for fentanyl. No one thought a baby would be exposed to fentanyl. That same month, a 16-month-old suddenly became unresponsive at home. Her parents drove the child to a local fire department. CPR was started and multiple doses of epinephrine were given to the baby. The child ended up in the ICU on a ventilator for 12 hours before waking up. A urine drug screen later was found to be positive for fentanyl. Again, back then, no one thought of fentanyl in babies or to give naloxone to babies. I'm proud to have led a project that encouraged all San Diego emergency departments to include fentanyl as part of their toxicology screen. What started as a pilot project ended up as Tyler's Law in California, and several other states followed California with similar legislation. The two fentanyl pediatric cases that I mentioned were discussed at our monthly Credo meeting, and we were able to send out educational memos to our EMS and emergency departments to make them aware of fentanyl and to give naloxone to unresponsive babies. Credo is a community response to drug overdose. I chair this committee in San Diego, bringing together high-level leaders in public health, public safety, and prevention to break through silos and work together to save lives in San Diego. To learn more about pediatric fentanyl poisonings, I reached out to Lori Jane Gleeha. Lori Jane Gleeha is a sharp, versatile, award-winning national investigative reporter for Scripps News. Scripps News is not related to the Scripps Hospital that I'm affiliated with as a doctor. It's a division of the E.W. Scripps Company with a large network affiliation of 330 television stations covering 81% of the United States. Chances are, if you're watching the news, you have seen it, a Scripps story. I met Lori Jane when she was investigating fentanyl poisonings among children. Since then, she poured hours into research to understand this tragedy. She was nominated for a National Emmy for her work. To learn more about Lori Jane Gleeha, check out the High Truth show notes. I recorded this conversation with Lori Jane on May 9th, 2025. Lori Jane Gleeha, welcome to High Truths.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me.
I've been really excited about this. We get to do the reverse because a while ago you came down to San Diego to interview me and now I get to do it to you.
Yes, this is wonderful. I appreciate you highlighting our work and the work of Scripps News. So thank you for having me.
No, of course. And I, like I told you, I have a new appreciation, renewed appreciation for the work that you do as an investigative reporter. Not just telling a story that we are used to seeing, you know, a news, a small story. You're changing heart and minds. You're educating. You're changing policies. It's amazing. And we're going to go into that. That you started your career at USC in broadcast journalism. What made you want to do that?
Yeah, actually, my career started in sixth grade when we got a video camera as a prize in a recipe contest. And I used to pretend to be a reporter as a kid growing up. And then I realized you could do this for a living. This is something amazing. So yeah, I went into that at USC. I found out broadcast journalism was an option, and I've always enjoyed observing people, and I've always enjoyed getting the truth and giving as much of the whole story as you possibly can. And so I think it's super important to interview a lot of different people and find the facts and make sure people have awareness about what's going on in their communities. And I've been very fortunate to be able to do this for the last 20 plus years now.
That's amazing. And not only that, you're at the top of your field. You were top of your class in school, and now top of your field with the awards on the stories that you do.
Yeah, we are very grateful for the opportunities here at Scripps News to be able to pursue really important stories. Our stories have run the gamut, and our role is to really dig into things, if that means gathering public records, pressing against people who are, in power, to make sure that, the public has all the information that they need so that they can make informed decisions. And I always like to say we love to shine light on things, give people as much information as they can so that they can decide what's best for their community.
That's awesome. And what kind of stories attract you? What do you like to go after?
Oftentimes, if there's something with a question in mind, like why is this happening or does this seem right? Those are a lot of the things we go after, things that we can ask more questions that the general public might not know how to do. So we often go after things where we have to be patient and file a records request so the public has access to public records. Those things can include, police reports or body camera footage or internal emails from a public agency. If there's a public hospital, sometimes some of those records are available, and you just have to know how to get them. And then that can help you piece together some things that you might not know all the details about, and somebody might not regularly just come forward to you and give you all the details. So sometimes you have to search for those. So I think those are the kinds of stories I seek out. And or sometimes if someone from the public calls and says, "Hey, look, this is not right. Can you check into it?" I often will take that tip as well. And a lot of times it's just something that I feel like there needs to be more things pulled, researched about something, something that I'm curious about as well.
Interesting. And does Scripps News give you the freedom to choose your stories, or you have to still, follow whatever mission or guideline that the agency gives you?
I've been very fortunate since I started here. Pretty much every single story that I've pitched, I've been able to go after. And that includes things from, we just did a huge investigation on the deadliest mass shooting from 2023 in Maine. I was a member of the U.S. Army Reserve, and something just seemed unusual. There was a lot of warning signs in that case, and we were wondering, how is it possible this guy was able to commit this shooting? So that was one of the things we decided we wanted to look into. We also did a series on political violence where we looked at, how often are threats being made at political figures? There's a variety of things. I have a variety of topics that I've gone after. And fortunately, yeah, a lot of the things that I've pitched, I've been able to do. And then, of course, if there's something in the news that's happening that needs more digging. For example, fentanyl deaths among babies, toddlers, and young children, also something that I was passionate about before I even got to Scripps News. I pitched it, they were on board. I have a wonderful partner that's been working with me throughout this process, and we've made a lot of progress on this investigation. So yeah, we're fortunate to have all the support we can get at Scripps News.
That's great. So we're going to dig into the pediatric poisoning, which you've been working on now for several years, but how did it start? Where did somebody die? You read the story. How was the very first tip come to you?
Yeah, so it's an interesting story. So I am now a national network TV reporter for Scripps News, but before that, I was a local news reporter in Denver, Colorado. And before I left my station, one of the stories I was interested in is fentanyl poisonings, opioid poisonings among young people. So I had put in a records request for a list of all of the people who are 18 or younger than 18, at the medical examiner's office, just so I could kind of get some sense of how often is this happening. And I wasn't really necessarily intending to do really young kids, or I don't know what I was going to do. But eventually I got a list, and I got it from different medical examiner offices, and I saw that there was a baby on the list. And I thought, oh my gosh, how does a baby get fentanyl? How is a baby dying of fentanyl? How often is this affecting little kids? Because sometimes you hear about teenagers who have unfortunately overdosed. And many times it's a person who is experimenting or, you know, knew that they were consuming something, but a baby or a toddler. So I had inquired about it, and it turned out that the police department hadn't really followed up on it. The case was kind of in limbo. They said, oh, you've got to wait for the medical or the autopsy report. And I did. I got the autopsy report, and it said right in there that this was the cause. And so I basically, the police then kind of reignited the case. And then I ended up leaving that station, and I came here to Scripps News, and I said, well, I wonder if we can do this on a national level. Can we look at how often this is happening to kids across the country? And when my partner came along, Brittany Freeman, she was on board, I was on board, and I remember the day we looked at each other and we're like, are we doing this? Because how this has started is we made our own spreadsheet from scratch. So basically we'd find a news story and just start documenting the kid's name, their age, where they were, where this happened. And then what we would do is try to get actual records from every single case. So then we'd look at child fatality reports. We'd look at autopsies. We'd request police reports. We'd talk to courthouses. We'd get arrest affidavits. It's a lot of work. We got a lot of denials. We had to do a lot of pushback. And we just started building this. And we're, for every single case, we now have more than, I think it's close to 450 cases in the spreadsheet that we've looked at across the country and that we have actual documentation for. And that's what we then started to do, is just track all of the trends. Like, what are all of the things that are common in these cases? And we wanted to bring it to light to people so that they could make change if they felt it was necessary.
That's amazing. And you know what, Laura Jane, is when I was at a point with it was oxycodone deaths, where I partnered with the medical examiner, and it was shocking, you know, what people die of from prescriptions I give. And that really changed my career. And you learn so much from people who died, what not to do, or, you know, it gives you a lot of prevention guidance by studying that. So that was very smart. And you're doing public health work, right? That's something you're acting like what a public health investigator should be doing, and you're doing. So that's amazing.
It's rewarding for us too, because we've had various people from around the country who are in the capacity of, you know, medical professionals. We've also had legislators, people who have asked us for our data or some of the information that we've gathered. And it is difficult because, you know, getting some of this information, as I said earlier, sometimes we got pushback because there's a lot of transparency issues and privacy issues. We're dealing with people's health issues. Also, when we want to talk to family members and things to try and get more information about some of these children, you know, it's a very difficult topic to talk about. And we tread really lightly and are trying to be as extremely sensitive and respectful as we can to these families, knowing that they are going through one of the most difficult traumas they probably will ever endure. So we've got to balance all of those things. But yes, we know that the work is important. We know it's valued by people who aren't just, you know, citizens, but people who are in power and in professions that deal with this as well.
Yeah, it does. And it's so impactful. So let's start with some of the stories of these babies who died of fentanyl. I think you started with a piece called The Silent Toll of the Fentanyl Crisis. So let's watch this clip.
Fire department.
Come in. I got up and everything was all over the bed and he was on top of me.
One of the other key mistakes we found is that caregivers are often accused of leaving drugs within easy reach of a curious child.
When I turned back around, he had the bag of pills in his hand and he's chewing up.
And he swallowed a pill.
I think he took one of my pills.
In hundreds of court documents we reviewed, we found drugs left on coffee tables, in a desk, lying next to candy, in a jewelry box. Kids also got a hold of items used to take drugs, like straws, foils, baggies, and syringe caps. This Kentucky mom said she left drugs in her purse before she fell asleep with her child.
That was in the bag.
Yeah, that was in the bag. And the plastic thing he was chewing on was fentanyl.
Yeah.
Her son, 2-year-old Jackson, did not survive.
So, Lori Jane, tell me about this this tragic story of Jackson.
Yeah, this was really difficult. So we don't ever know what we're going to get when we put in these records requests. So we'll read about a case, we'll get some details, maybe it was in the news, or we'll find the child fatality report. And then we go to the next level of trying to get more specific details about what happened. And part of that is requesting, we often request body camera footage. So that's the video that police wear when they're on a scene. and a lot of police departments.
And that's what we just saw, right?
Yeah, yeah. And so that, and we'll often request interrogation videos of parents, 911 calls too, just so we can get some insight of what's happening. And this was a very tragic situation, but we felt it was important to show because it shows the, you know, the horror in this person's heart and mind, you know, that she's deep within, you know, her substance use disorder. She's unable to realize that she's left this purse out, which is accessible to her child. And a lot of these cases that we've seen parents who have been users and they thought, I was really careful. I kept it out of the reach of my child. I fell asleep. You know, we've seen several cases in which a parent used some drugs and then they fell asleep with their child nearby. And of course, these toddlers are curious kids. I mean, all they're doing is trying and learning and touching and putting things in their mouth. And that is how they are ingesting it. They're, you know, grabbing it, swallowing a pill, touching the substances, putting it in their, you know, or if it's in their nose, somehow they're getting this. And in this case, you could see that this woman obviously had not intended that this would happen. And her, unfortunately, her child got the drugs.
And babies, they just copy everything you do. I think with her, she was using a straw to put it in her nose, and the baby sees it, and then the baby takes the straw and sucks on the straw. And the falling asleep, that's what opiates do to you, right? That's mm-hmm. the whole, that is the high that people are looking for. That was really hard. And she ended up in jail?
Yes, I believe, and we've done so many cases now. I believe she got a pretty harsh sentence in prison.
Yeah.
For that. And I know that there was, I think she also, if I remember correctly, did attempt to appeal that. I don't remember the exact prison sentence, but I do remember it was pretty significant because we've seen a variety across the country of how these cases are handled, prosecuted or not. And then sentences are sometimes very lengthy. Some are very short.
Yeah. Some are there's no consistency.
Right. So depending on which jurisdiction you're in and which state, but I know that this, I did speak at one point to the family of this woman, you know, who talked about, the thing that I think maybe some people may not connect is that these parents absolutely love their children so much. They would never want this to happen. You know, it's not that they didn't love their child or didn't want to protect them, but they're also dealing with this other.
Yeah, the drugs took over their brain.
Stolen their brain, yeah.
One of the videos you showed is a cute little baby in a homeless encampment, I think, Ariel Rose. And you could see her blowing kisses and being so cute and repeatedly found an encampment and died. And that was like, should have been preventable, right?
Yeah, and eventually, you know, I don't believe she actually died there. But it was something, I think one of the things we've been looking at is just the communication and what can be done when there have been multiple interactions between the family, the caregiver, and the police, or the family or the caregiver and Child Protective Services. Early on, when we first started this project, when we just had kind of done, I think, a little over 200 cases that we had analyzed, more than half of the cases that we looked at had some sort of previous interaction with Child Protective Services or police related to either child abuse or drugs. And, you know, it's very difficult to get to the bottom of what to do because there's a fine line in a lot of these different states on how much is too much interaction. When do you take the child out of the house? When do you leave them in the house? How many chances does someone get? We've seen a few cases, though, where it was like 12 or more contacts with the family or the caregiver or the person. And, you know, you just want to ask the question, well, what happened? Why wasn't there more?
Yeah, there are clues. I remember when I did the death diary research, kind of like you, I looked at everybody who died of a medication and studied their medications. They had several contacts with emergency departments. There are several clues that could have predicted that this is somebody who could die. And I think you're finding that as well.
Right. And yeah, it's just, and there's not one solution to this. You know, we have talked to leaders at these different organizations, and a lot of times they're they're understaffed and overworked. And, you know, but, and there are many cases in which positive things have happened to kids. You know, unfortunately, we often are hearing about and reporting about these big tragedies. You don't always hear about all the cases in which somebody has been rescued or saved or moved or a death has been prevented, which is important work that is being done every single day as well.
Yeah, that's true. You also interviewed a mom in jail, mother of Madison. And that was amazing that she was willing to speak to you. But I think that clip was important because you could see how she did not intend to for her baby to die. And she says there's not a day that she doesn't have a picture in her mind of holding her baby, which is much worse for her than sitting in prison.
Right. And it's devastating to go and do these interviews because, you know, it's impossible to not see the and feel the emotion that's going on in these people's minds. And she admitted that she was basically in denial about her drug use and how it might impact her child. And even in, we got her interrogation records too. And I think at one point the police had asked her, is it possible that she ingested any drugs or anything like that? And she had said no. And one of her tips for the people who might be struggling with drug use is, if you can, be honest, because if you can get the help, that's how you're going to get it. If you are honest with what's going on with you, especially if you have a child or a young life that might be impacted by what you're doing, you know, the way to get help is to tell people what's going on. And I know that's often extremely difficult for people to make that decision, but when there's another little life there, you don't often get a second chance.
Yeah. And that, so that was a mom who, you know, was obviously in pain from that. And then you also had a grandma, I think Ursula, Haley's mom. Tell us about that interaction.
Yes. And we actually spoke to Madison's mom as well, or Madison's grandmother as well in Missouri. So the mother of the woman who was in prison in that case. And then, yes, we also spoke to a grandmother in Maine who was just, you know, I think often what's hard, and I think one thing that we want people to know about too, is that often these families can be torn apart. You know, it's not just the child that's been affected. It's not just the parent or the caregiver of that child, but it's also all these other people in the family that have been affected by this that now have trauma moving forward. I also spoke to a grandmother. She hasn't appeared on camera yet in this series, but I've been talking to her for, I would say, close to a couple of years now. She lost her grandchild. And it's really sad because there was another little boy in the home, and the parents of those kids ended up going to prison. The other little boy is now being adopted by a new family. And the grandmother doesn't really have any rights in this situation, in this particular situation. And it's been devastating for her because it's close to the last 3 years. She's not even been able to see this surviving grandchild who was someone that she loved, you know. And I think that's the behind the scenes story, is these cases can go on and on for many years. They can affect many people. They can be traumatic for more than you might guess. And, you know, if there's anything that we can do, and that's part of why we're doing this project, is to bring this to light, to shed light on it so people know, you know, this is happening to hundreds of children across the country, and, you know, it's not talked about enough.
Yeah, yeah. And it's theoretically all preventable. It should be preventable. But yeah, I relate it to those because I'm a grandma too. You know, being the attachment of a grandparent is, you know, almost like a mom. You know, or even more. Like, I think I appreciate more of my grandkids than I did when I was a mom, just because I have more time and patience.
Right. Right. Yes. And you're like a little bit removed from, yeah, you can.
All the good.
Yes, exactly.
All the good is filtered. Mitchell Robinson, that story was tragic too. Want to tell us about and that cute little boy.
Yeah. That was a devastating case. And that case led to a lot of change in that state. People got fired. There was legislation that has happened as a result of that, but legislation that happened after that happened as well. And I can go into that in a minute. But his case was particularly devastating and it touches upon awareness of what might be in the child's system. So he had gone to the hospital with overdose symptoms and responded to Narcan, but initially the tests did not show that they didn't test for fentanyl, so it didn't show that he had fentanyl in his system. And so repeatedly he ended up going back to the same household where he was being poisoned. And there had also been at one point a drug raid on that house, and there was a lack of communication also between at various points between what was going on in the police world and what was going on in the child protection world, and just and at the hospital there's a lot of communication that wasn't happening as well as it could have. And you know, the child ended up going back to the hospital. There were three different times when he was experiencing overdose symptoms, and unfortunately on the third time he did not survive. And I will say, in Louisiana, since then, it's interesting, we talked to a legislator there who proposed a law. Whether or not he was fully aware, he proposed a law based on something that happened with a friend of his had an adult friend who had overdosed and died, and nobody knew it was fentanyl in his system or in their system. So they ended up asking this legislator, hey, could you run a bill that would, you know, require fentanyl to be added as testing, like the bill that you wrote in California. And so he was on board with that. And then when he went to pitch it, he made it just for children. So it ended up passing last summer. And so now many children have been found to have fentanyl in their system. They've been tested for it. And, you know, hopefully it's led to lives saved after that. But it was really interesting because he pitched that law without actually, I don't think, having full knowledge of all of the details about the Mitchell Robinson case, but there have been many kids in that state that have
been affected. Several years ago, I don't think many physicians understood that in a drug panel, when it says opiate at negative, it's just heroin and morphine, and it doesn't include the synthetic fentanyl. So I think there were a lot of mistakes like that. They're like, oh, well, there's no opiate, so maybe it wasn't the Narcan that woke you up. Maybe it was fentanyl. And there was that lack of education that I think we filled that gap now that people know. Definitely all over California where this law exists, that gap is there. But it's like, yes, it was like how many times? It was very sad. How do you convince families to talk to you to something so sensitive, something, you know, there's shame in using drugs, right? But let alone having a baby die from drugs.
I come at this at a point of sensitivity and, you know, just, I never am judgmental of anybody or if past any sort of anything. Like, I come very objectively to this and with the understanding that everybody, there's a lot of parts of a story that need to be told and a lot of layers to why some things happen and a lot of information that needs to be told. And so I'm very respectful of everybody that I'm talking to, whether they are responsible for the tragedy or not. I think it's important to hear all of the voices, because how are you ever going to, you know, fix a situation if you don't have all the components and all of the information? So I do come at it with I'm a very compassionate person. I think it's important with any interview subject you're doing. You know, as a reporter, you may be interviewing someone one day that, you know, has everything that they could possibly need. And then you can be interviewing someone the next day that, you know, is needs a lot of things. So I think it's just important to treat every person that you're interviewing as a person and how you would want to be treated. And so that's kind of how I go about requesting interviews. And sometimes it takes a few conversations. Let me chat with you first. Let me talk to you about where I'm coming from. You know, these are the kinds of topics we're going to discuss. You know, I just am very respectful of the other person and treating them how I would want to be treated. And with the idea that I would like to get in some information and some insight that might raise awareness about this type of situation.
Right. So you've been working on this for several years, pouring in, you know, thousands of hours and watching things that are very painful. How does it affect you personally? You said you're a very empathetic person. How does that?
Well, yeah. So I'm trying not to cry right now because I usually do and I probably will, but see, now it's happening. No, it's
hard.
No, it is. It's difficult. You like in any story that you do, it's like, it's tough. And we spend
you know, hours watching this, the most devastating day in someone's life on body cam or in the interrogation records, and you hear the horror in people's voices in the 911 calls. And, you know.
Yeah. And Lori Jane, it's hard. I so understand what you're going through, but I think that you continue to do it because you're making a difference. And I can attest to that as a doctor, that you have made a difference. You've made a difference in my life as a physician dealing with this. And you're really doing population health and making improvements. And I think you see that, and that's what makes you continue.
Right. I didn't mean to get so emotional, but it is. It's true. It's like, it is. It's not like we're just like zombies or anything like that. You know, we are watching this. We do think it's important. This is why we are showing this stuff. We are wading through all this stuff. You know, it's we don't want everybody to have to do this. We're doing it. We're bringing the most important things to light so that people can see it and feel it as well. And
yeah,
it's tough. And so this is why sometimes we decide we're going to do a story about sports or something like that. So it's not,
to take care of yourself,
switch it up occasionally.
And you know what? I've talked to law enforcement officers who also, like, you know, who've investigated like 400 of these fentanyl deaths, and it pays a toll on you, on them too. And everybody who does that.
And probably so, you as well, all of the patients that you've had to see, and you've kind of had to, at some point you have to kind of just separate yourself a bit from feeling all of the things that the patient is feeling, I'm guessing as well. But and we do, like, I have, you know, at some points it is, you just kind of have to take a breath and not get too sucked into somebody else's situation. But it's hard not to. You can't not, because you have to care. You have to care about what you're reporting on too. So
yeah, definitely. So not all babies died. You've reported on kids who've survived too.
Yes.
And this, I don't know how you got this story on Addison, but I want to share this one with our listeners as well.
Like, my eyes were like drifting off trying to, and then everyone's like, no, just wake up.
How serious do you think this whole thing was?
Very serious, because if I fell asleep, I could have died.
Addison says she picked up a pill in her kindergarten classroom and ate it, not knowing it was a drug or that it contained the deadly substance fentanyl.
Do you got a minute to talk to me a little about the incident at Grenada School last week?
Scripps News obtained these audio interviews recorded by investigators. You can hear that staff members at Addison's school seemed confused by her symptoms.
Her pupils are pinpoint. Her breathing is really labored and shallow.
And Scripps News could find no documentation that anyone gave her the overdose reversal drug, Narcan.
We honestly thought she had a seizure or something.
Kind of looked like a concussion or something. I don't know what it was.
Addison's mother says even the doctors at the first hospital they visited seemed baffled by what was happening to the little girl.
They were worried about new onset diabetes with her, and I had mentioned, do we think she ate something or ingested something? Drugs weren't something that ever popped into my mind. The pediatrician came in and he felt like she was on something. We did a tox panel, and at that point the tox panel came back negative.
How frustrating was that?
That's what was scary. So then it went from she ingested something to, well, maybe she has a brain tumor.
Addison's initial drug panel came back negative because it tested for other substances, but not fentanyl. It wasn't until the next day at another hospital when more comprehensive drug testing confirmed what made Addison so sick.
So, Lori Jane, tell us about Addison. How did you find her? And what an incredible young lady.
Yes. So her case was one of the many, you know, that we kind of encountered through news reports and things like that. And then I think my colleague was the one that focused in on maybe we could talk to somebody that's actually, you know, a positive story, which is, you know, one of our goals all along was, you know, it would be wonderful to be able to tell something where there's somebody that a vibrant child that made it through that we could also provide some information about. So we started digging on that. We started putting in records requests for the police report and things like that. And then we ended up contacting the family, and the mother was very kind and agreed to allow Addison to speak with us. And we also were very respectful of her and understanding that she's a little kid, but it was important to hear, you know, what she went through, why she picked up the pill. She wasn't even sure why she picked up the pill in her classroom. And, but what was telling about her case, and in a lot of these cases, and I think with more education, people are learning over time, but a lot of times people are like, why would a kid have a drug. Why would a kid have fentanyl? So a lot of times when...
At school.
Right. Well, especially at school. And so when, you know, they go in for treatment or that kind of thing, it's not the first thing that crosses the mind. Let's try Narcan or let's try something that might help with reversing the opioid, what happened with the opioid. And so that's what happened with Addison. They didn't initially know that that's what was causing all of this. And they thought it was a bunch of other symptoms and things like that. So they tried all sorts of other things. And then eventually, you know, they did figure out that this was what was causing her and she to have these symptoms, and she was able to recover. But, you know, it became a very tense situation, and who knows what would have happened if somebody hadn't figured that out at some point. But it's true. These things can happen. And I think one of the important things that we've learned over time and in our data, we had done some analysis, a lot of these cases in which the kid got Narcan in time and that there was obviously appropriate medical treatment also provided, the kids were able to survive. Unfortunately, a lot of these cases, somebody waits for a very, very long time before they call for help, or, you know, did not administer Narcan, not knowing that you could give naloxone or Narcan to a young child. And then well, I think another thing important for people to know is that sometimes after you've gotten a dose of it, that doesn't mean you're just out of the woods. A lot of these kids have had to have Narcan drips. You know, they've been held at a hospital overnight for multiple days. And so it's not just one and you're out of the woods if you have it, but it is extremely important, we found, and important for people to know that this can be used on a child.
Yeah. And, you know, when we first learned about, like, I didn't know that, right? Like a baby found down, I wouldn't think, you know, several years ago that to think of fentanyl. And so we had also questions like, what dose, how much do you give? And it's just like, just give it all. Just give the adult dose, even to a little baby. You won't hurt them by giving the whole dose. And I think in Addison's story, I think it's interesting. She goes, I don't know why I put it in my mouth, but that's what kids do.
Yeah. I mean, adults do that too.
And it's just an instinct. It's like, here's a little candy, you know, I'm going to put it in my mouth.
Right.
And it was interesting, I think, in her case too, that the ER didn't have, they have the regular opiate screens, which is negative. So like, okay, well, maybe it's not fentanyl. Like what, you know, who would think? And only later did they like send away. And we fixed that problem in California. Like that doesn't happen anymore. And so that's interesting. And how is Addison doing now?
It's been a while since I've spoken to that family, but I will say at last check, I think she was performing in a play. She does the physical activities outside. When we were there with the family, she's riding her bike. She has a bunch of other little sisters with her. So, you know, the family seems to be, at the last that I spoke to them, they seem to be doing great. And I think they're extremely, extremely grateful that Addison is still with them, because it was touch and go for a minute there.
Yeah. I think you even asked her, like, are you worried, you think about it? And she goes, nah, you know, I don't think of my
house. Yeah, she seems so resilient as a little kid. And I think part of it is the understanding of what the seriousness of what happened to her. And I think at that young age, it's probably very difficult. You know, I even asked her, do you know what fentanyl is? And that was my favorite, most innocent part of the interview. And she was like, no. And then I asked her to guess what it was. And she went on to say, you know, a drug. But I just thought that was so precious to hear from this little child who is, you know, doesn't really understand the magnitude of how serious this.
I just was caught, like, how you were able to interview a little girl about, you know, she was 8 years old, what happened to her when she was five, you know?
Yeah. Well, it was.
That was amazing.
Yeah. The family was just very gracious and allowed us and felt that it was an important story. And also, I think they were wanting some help with this too, because they didn't have a lot of answers about what happened with the police. There was a whole police investigation that went on. And when we were looking at it, it seemed like the case had been closed with nobody held accountable. And so we did ask some questions. We went to the sheriff. We showed up. We told him we were going to show up. They kind of stopped responding to a lot of our requests for information. And so I said, well, you know, we might show up here. And so we did. We flew to California and we waited outside the sheriff's office. And sure enough, he walked up and I walked out and introduced myself and said, I've got a lot of questions for you. And Addison's mom later said that a detective did get in touch with them again, and they did do something to advance the case. I don't know that it actually ended up resulting in any charges or anything like that, but at least they got some additional attention for that, for them. And, you know, that was something they were left with, was a lot of questions about what happened in that case.
I think you reported also there was an assistant teacher who was using fentanyl and then got rid of it in the house, and she got fired, I think. And
So that teacher ended up, well, yeah, they part, I will have to look up the details exactly of what happened, but I know that they, the school parted ways with that teacher, and she was a teacher's aide. And yes, there, that same week she overdosed and her husband, you know, called for help and basically admitted that there was there were drugs in the house and they had gotten rid of them. So that teacher, whether or not she had anything to do specifically with this, that was never something that was
proven
or charged, yeah. But it was certainly an unusual turn of events during that same week when Addison also consumed a fentanyl pill.
Yeah. So now let's talk about fentanyl testing, which is how you and I connected. You're doing like your, you know, research of these babies, and, you know, and I was really pushing to advocate to include fentanyl based on some cases. I think I would have done a much better job if I had all your cases. I would just, I would have just showed people your clips, and it's like, that's, you know, seal the deal. But you came down to San Diego and interviewed me. So I think I'll share with the audience the clip that you did of me, yours truly.
Are we doing enough to protect children?
No, I don't think we're doing enough. No.
Dr. Ronit Lev is a San Diego emergency physician who served as chief medical officer for the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy under President Trump. She also helped draft California's Tyler's Law, enacted in 2023. That law requires hospitals to include fentanyl testing when they screen a patient for other drugs.
I think every hospital should do it anyway, whether there's a law or not. You put the specimen and it goes in these little bins.
Lev showed us how the testing would work.
So, but you're saying this is something that every hospital should get?
Yes. It's like, so when people say, well, we can't do it in a rural hospital, it's like, yes, you can. I'll just teach you.
So, Lori Jane, thank you so much for coming down and doing that interview, because I felt, you know, using someone from the media, you have a lot more power than a doctor like me about getting the word out and showing how important that is. Like, I could do the science and I know about the lab and I could explain why it's important, but you're able to do in a much better way than I can with examples and getting that word out. So I really thank you for that.
Right. Well, I appreciate that you were so candid and willing to talk with us about what your efforts have been and how this works, because this wasn't just something that popped up randomly. We had done a lot of research across the country by reading some of these child fatality reports. And I don't know if people know what it is. I keep mentioning it, but a child fatality report in many different states maybe has a different term, but it's basically what happens once a child dies. There's a team that comes in and then they investigate all of the things that went wrong or went right. And a lot of times they'll highlight something that's a systemic issue that might need to be fixed. And so that's kind of sometimes where we found, or they'll make a recommendation for improvement of something or how to avoid a situation like this later. And I think one of the things we had found by going through some of these reports in different states, you know, in the East Coast and the West Coast, in Colorado, there were different reports that had come out saying it would be this child did not get tested for fentanyl. This, you know, could have been recognized sooner. A lot of times these cases, people don't recognize fentanyl to start, and then they don't find out until the autopsy. And so if there's a way to find it out right away when they're in the hospital, this was something that had been made as a recommendation by medical professionals, which is why then we wanted to explore how does this law work? And obviously you had made progress in California. And then recently we continued our reporting on that, you know, many, many months later. I think when we talked to you, maybe it was 2023 even. I can't remember. It was a while ago when we talked to you. Yeah. And then we decided, let's look into this because it seems like more states are starting to propose more of these laws. And we found a lot of states had either enacted legislation or had proposed it. And so that's when we, you know, ended up finding those other California twins that also seemed to have.
Yeah. And, you know, and I feel like I was a little bit of an investigative reporter too, because I asked, like, why don't we have a fentanyl test? And it's like, well, we don't have it. It's like, well, why? It's expensive. We don't have the equipment. And I had to dig and talk to the people who manufactured and found out that, no, it's available. It works in everybody's machine. It costs 75 cents. And I ended up, you know, this was not my expertise, but I ended up being the expert on the test and teaching hospitals how to implement it, because it wasn't that hard. I realized it was an education gap, not a financial gap, not a resource gap, and that and every hospital can do it, even though they just didn't know that they could.
And I think that's, we have also seen other people have learned from the research that you had done. For example, in Virginia, they are one of the most recent states to pass a law like this. And, you know, they were giving me information and I was asking them, okay, can you show me your statistics or what, you know, what information, where did you get your information on this? And then they spoke about you and how they had consulted with you about it. So I know that a lot of the information that you've been able to provide has been useful for other states. In
it's a partnership because I also sent them your clip. but yeah, they didn't realize, and they tried the law before talking to me, and they said they got pushback from the medical community. I said, just let me talk to them. I know the language. I know how physicians and medical community think. I understand the resistance. Give me a conversation with them and I'll change their mind. And because physicians think, well, we don't want an unfunded mandate and we can't go ever. And I explained that this is not asking you to do anything extra. You're going to get an extra piece of information without even asking for it.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting, though. That is in the research we've done in some of these states that, or just in the research that we've done, some of, like, at least one medical group said they were hesitant to support or, you know, something that was unfunded, something that's mandated, especially with out of concern for rural hospitals and places like that. And another people that we've heard, you know, from
now, that was, by the way, that's American College of Emergency Physicians. So that's, like, I belong to that organization. And I'm sure, and I agree with their statement, we don't want an unfunded mandate, because everything falls down on the emergency departments. You know, you need to do HIV testing and you need to screen for this and screen for that. And we end up not doing actual emergency work with all the other mandates that they ask us to do. But this is not a mandate. This is just asking for fentanyl to be included in what you're already doing. So there's no objection. And actually, the California chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians fully backed the California legislation, Tyler's Law, and helped me with that.
I was going to say, I think that group was, I would need to look at my notes again. So I've got to look at that, because I think it was actually a different group that I was referencing. It's a pediatric group that, and I think ASAP actually did, I don't know if that's how you, the short terminology, actually did say that they.
Oh, it's all in the language, right? So if they put it in the language like I wrote it for California, there, it's a no-brainer. You'd be in favor. If you added it, if you worded it like everybody who overdoses has to get a drug screen, that would be a no-go, because we can't force people to, against their will, when you're in the emergency department. I can't make you give me urine. I can't force a blood test on you, right? That's, but if we're ordering it anyway, why should it not include fentanyl? Mm-hmm.
And I would say, like, I know that's something we talked about during that course of the interview. I know some other medical people have said, well, I know how, if I'm getting someone in this hospital with symptoms of an overdose, I should know how to treat them for that, whether or not I have a test or not, which I think you had indicated well. But I think it's also important for patients to kind of know what is causing it, what's in their system, having some sort of confirmation as well. I think when we did the interview initially, that was kind of what we discussed. But I know that's one of the other feelings that's out there about that is just,
yeah. Well, I can. And your stories make that case for me. Like, it's true. I don't have to have a CAT scan or blood work or urine, anything, when someone is in an emergency situation. I fix the vital signs. I get you breathing again. I get your heart pumping again. I don't need any lab work. But that information afterwards helps your treatment. And you showed case after case of these babies who they thought, okay, well, I'm just going to send them home. Their test is negative. You know, they don't have the information to make a life change. And you, I think you made the perfect example with all your reporting of how that makes a difference. And then you went further. I think with Epic, you partnered. Here you are, like, you're a public health officer, Lori Jane, going to Epic, the largest electronic health record system in the United States, and you partnered with them to get data. So tell us that. And then you should be a published author by now.
They were really cool. No, yeah, we did. We talked with them about what can we get? What kind of information can we get from this? And they agreed. They have access, much more access, because, you know, as a journalist, we don't have access to all the records that are kept at a hospital. There's a lot of privacy concerns and things like that. But when you're a high profile research organization, you know, you do get access to that. So they were able to search through all of their data and provide some important information about, you know, testing in young kids and that kind of thing. So it was very cool to have, you know, other medical people appreciate what we're doing and say, you know, yeah, this is important for us to have information and bring it to light.
Yeah. And I think a cool, and you have like cool little graphics in your reporting of 1,370 hospitals. And you looked at ages 1 to 12 of kids who overdose. And in 2021, less than 2% were tested. And then in 2023, 10% were tested. And 77% were positive, you know, so you're, you know, giving that information and that improvement over time. And they also made a point that you found out with Epic that a lot of hospitals still to this date are not including fentanyl in their drug screen. And there's no excuse for that, I think.
I think there's a lot of information that's come out over time that people are learning. And I think, you know, a lot of our reporting sometimes is based on older situations too. So for example, sometimes these cases take a long time to investigate, or that any of the details about them don't become public for a couple of years. So then when we're reading it, we find out like all of these things that have been said. And that's, I think that's what happens with data sometimes too, is you can only get stuff as quickly as it is happening. And I think maybe AI will help with some of that stuff when we move forward. But, you know, so I think fortunately there's been a lot of, you know, education over time. And I think even just back to the whole Narcan issue, we just got a body cam just the other day, but it was from several years ago, and we saw a police officer suggesting that he was going to give Narcan, and someone else was like, no, that's probably not what's going on. And so this child never got the Narcan, and the child did not survive. And, you know, just all sorts of information.
We're trying to like just give it and think later. You know, don't make the diagnosis, just give it and then think what it was. Because even I, with, you know, 30 plus years of experience, I'm not sure right away. So you just give it and then figure it out. And I think that's another educational point that that we should do based on what you're telling me. I want to share my favorite video clip that you have. And for our listeners, usually they're listening audio, but this will be on YouTube as well. So you could watch the videos of this episode. But this is my favorite because it answers the question of, you know, this testing, this Tyler's Law, and does it make a difference? You know, like, does your reporting, Jessica Dixon, did my advocacy make a difference? And I think, you know, your video of the twins really answers that. So let me share that.
From my recollection, the times that I was using, it wasn't in the house. I mean, I couldn't tell you the amount of times that I just never was home.
But the day she rushed her baby to Children's Hospital of Orange County in Southern California, a test confirmed the deadly drug was in his system.
He could have overdosed and died.
You think this test saved his life?
Saved his life.
Did it
saved his life.
Did it save your life?
It saved my life.
Under a California state law that went into effect in 2023, most California hospitals must include a test for fentanyl when conducting a drug screening to help diagnose someone's condition.
How scary is it to know that both of your children had this drug in their system?
It's indescribable. Like, I don't think scary is the word. Horrifying.
They wouldn't be here, neither would I.
So this is my favorite because you really showed, you know, people say, do you make a difference? And this mom says, yeah, the test saved our baby's life and they saved my life.
Yeah, no, it's, this took us a really long time to track this family down to get in touch with them. And I'm so glad that they were willing to talk about this candidly. And also that they have extremely cute children. And it was so wonderful to be able to do a happy story where these kids are thriving and playing with a balloon and running around and smiling and being happy and giving their parents, you know, hugs and kisses. And I think, you know, it was very important to talk to. So they are in California, and basically the mom did credit the fact that her child was tested for the fact that they're all here today and doing much better. And she talked about, and I'm sure it's going to be a long road for her, because she talked about how she, you know, and the father of the kids have had a long road with drugs, drug use, and being off and on. And they were able to, and basically the backstory is one day she noticed that her kid was having a lot of saliva issue. And, you know, she did take him to the hospital and they tested him for fentanyl. And so that's what got the police to go to the other twin and make sure that he was okay. And, you know, fortunately she's doing much better now. And we wish them the best moving forward as far as making sure that their family stays together.
Yeah. That was amazing because she credited, and he did too, the test. So, and that was a test in California that we passed, and we get to see how that made a difference. Julie Shamish, Tyler's mom, that the bill is named after, was also, she was like, you know, so touched by this story and how that made a difference and how that saved a life. And that story, has, you know, several teaching points. One of the you know, importance of testing, recognizing symptoms, and also the other twin had no symptoms but tested positive. And that was another teaching point that, you know, that anybody in a house with fentanyl and children, the children should be tested because they could be exposed. And it's like a fine line of life and death with the dosage of fentanyl. So that is important. And
well, it was interesting, too, talking to the mother, because she at first was kind of, during the course of the interview, was kind of at first saying she didn't, with the child that had the symptoms, she thought they were symptoms of something else. And even medical people had thought they were symptoms of something else. But in retrospect, she kind of indicated that maybe all along, this saliva issue with her child was actually him reacting to fentanyl. And some of the things that he was showing may have been symptoms of this. And so, you know, just awareness of that too. And that's another story that we did, was just showing how people are describing how their children are, you know, reacting, what they're seeing and what they're hearing. A lot of times they don't realize what it is, but a lot of them said the same thing. So we ended up doing a story on that as well, where, you know, people talked about the kid sounds like they're snoring or they're gasping for air. And it was repeatedly, we heard this. So I think it's important. That was an important thing we wanted to bring out too, was just, if you hear these things and you know that you have this in your home, or that the child may have been in a place where you don't know the people that well, you know, this is something that you should be aware of.
Yes. And that, you read my mind, because that was the next point I was going to make. Awesome. Because, and that's the teaching points. And again, like, your stories cover so many teaching points for medical, for red flags. So the medical teaching points, and this is true, what you're describing is not just for babies, it's for adult. And the typical, you know, things that they teach about an overdose is pinpoint pupils, unresponsiveness. By that time, it's too late, because even in adults, we hear, you know, well, I heard a lot of snoring, weird snoring, so I thought he was asleep, and in the morning, they're dead. So we've, you know, people have coined it as a death rattle. And you have stories showing about, like, what the saliva or the croup or gasping or some type of rattling. That often happens before they stop breathing, and that's a time to intervene. And that's not in traditional medical teaching that you really highlight. And I think that's so important that I have a video of it as well. I want to share from that you shared with me.
Scripps News spent years obtaining and reviewing more than 110 hours of footage and phone calls from police and court files, so we can show you what caregivers are seeing when seconds count.
He's lethargic. He looks purple and blue. He's breathing, but he's like...
And Scripps News obtained this Ohio police video in which a father describes similar symptoms.
I didn't start making these weird noises like I never heard of. Yeah, like...
According to police, first responders did not administer Narcan, a life-saving opioid antidote, because they confused the child's symptoms for croup, a sickness that can cause coughing and heavy breathing.
What are you thinking?
Croup.
Croup? And he's unconscious?
Croup.
He's what?
He's got a croup.
But the child survived after receiving treatment at a hospital.
So that's a pretty incredible video. Seeing a baby who's floppy, you know, we say flop, not responsive. You showed videos of a baby with a rattle, and even the medical professional said, you know, they could tell something was wrong, but they didn't have the classic pinpoint pupils and completely unresponsive. They're still like staring, because it depends on the dose of, you know, before you're alive and fine to dead, there's an in between. And that's what we're seeing, these floppy babies who are completely unresponsive. And in the clip that you show, naloxone, and the baby's now kind of awake.
Yeah, and the medical provider says, you know, I think we should try this. I think we should try Narcan, you know, or naloxone, you know, again, I think in the New York case, where the kid is in the back of the ambulance and they ended up giving him the drug, it took several minutes. I mean, we had to pare it down for the purpose of telling a TV story, but it took several minutes, you know, for the kid to react. And then that kid, I believe, also had to be on a Narcan drip at the hospital. So yeah. Again, despite the fact that he woke up, he wasn't out of the woods. He needed more treatment. And that's why it was super important to get the actual medical professionals there on the scene to help in a situation like that.
Right. So it's so, so important. And I guess I should ask permission from you. I would love to use these clips. They make such great medical education and training.
Well, my boss said that, yeah, we've put the Scripps News, if as long as you continue to attribute it to Scripps News, you know, my boss said we could put it in here in this podcast. And, you know, I think, I just so it's clear, yes, Scripps News has been very supportive of us being able to do these investigations. I mean, it's unheard of that you can follow an investigation for close to 2 years. And we pitched that to them. You know, we had done a series of stories. We took a little bit of a hiatus to do some other reporting. And then we thought, you know what? We really want to make an impact on this. And I think, so we started to do some more stories. We had gathered so much data. We had more than 400 cases. And we're just, my colleague and I were like, oh, this trend is happening. This trend is happening. This trend is happening. We need yeah. people to know about these things. And the only people that are going to tell this story is us, because we've gathered this data. So if we could do a few more stories, and it's been so wonderful. Our bosses have been extremely supportive of us being able to put this out. And Scripps News owns TV stations across the country. So not only does our stuff appear on the network, but we also appear on these local stations around the country. And it's wonderful that we know we're making an impact, because even just yesterday, I got a Facebook message from someone in Florida who happened to see our story, who said, I didn't know about this. You know, can you tell me more? And I've gotten different messages along the way from various people who have seen our reporting. So we know, and we appreciate all of the support that we've gotten from our team and from people like you who are featuring our reporting, so that we can make an impact and we can make a difference. And again, the end goal is, if people have information, they can figure out what changes are necessary for their lives so that they can make improvements.
Yeah, I think we with Scripps News, of some of these videos really teach on recognizing an overdose, treating an overdoses. And also the other thing that I think that you really highlight that I would learn from listening to your stories is the red flags and failure of a system. Like, no baby should be in an encampment. And after a second overdose, probably even the first overdose, you need to, you know, to look into the safety of the child. And in your stories, again, multiple touches with CPS before a child died, and lacks of communication between law enforcement and CPS. And then, of course, the fentanyl testing. I mean, like, I can make a list based, you know, a medical list based on your it's, I think it's not even fair to call it stories, your investigative public health, you know, analysis, that we can make some conclusions.
Well, I appreciate you calling it that, because that's what we want to do. We know we really care a lot, and we are very thorough, in-depth reporters. And, you know, we are high quality people that want to make a difference in people's lives. So thank you for bringing that. I mean, and another issue, you know, you just brought up the communication thing. That was another big deal that we have done several stories on, that we've noticed as recommendations or systemic gaps in systems across the country, was communication between all of the different parties that might interact with a child. That includes a police department, that includes the healthcare provider, and that also includes child protective services. And it's difficult. Nothing is ever perfect, but the more increased communication that can happen, the better it is for the child. Giving that information, you know, we saw a few cases here where I am in Colorado where police did not, they had some information about a parent having some sort of drug issue with the child present, and that information just didn't get relayed to the next level. And in two cases, we saw kids die months later. And one gap that was highlighted was, had this communication been better, who knows what would have been the end result. So I know that here in Colorado, they're working on that, trying to improve that system. And I know, you know, that's not unique to just one state. So that's an issue that could be improved probably in many places.
Yeah. And as far as fentanyl testing, I don't know if Colorado has it yet, but if you ever run into things, connect them with me, because I'll change their mind.
I have. Well, you know, it's interesting because we did do a poll of all of the different states. I think there are 14 different states that had proposed laws. I think there are about six, I think, that have enacted I might be off by one, that have actually enacted a law. And Colorado is not one of them. I did talk to a few different legislators on both sides of the aisle about what their thoughts were about it. But at this point, it's not something that has been even proposed here in Colorado. And I know some other states are trying to gather information to see what's best. And obviously, this is a law, as you know, also named after Tyler, that, you know, a similar legislative proposal has been made in a bipartisan way in Congress right now. I think twice they've tried to.
Yes, Senator Liu, I've talked to their office.
Yeah, so, you know, that's something that it's been being discussed not only in local jurisdictions or in state jurisdictions, but also federally.
Yeah, yeah. Goes too slow. By that time, we'll have like a different drug that is moving on to. So let me ask you, is this story over? I mean, we are seeing fentanyl deaths decline. In San Diego last year, looking at deaths in, you know, under 18, under 17, we've had none. So is this still a problem? Is this still an open story?
So we still have at least one more big project in us related to this. And we are planning to do an educational program that people maybe could share and maybe make a difference in different states with all kind of bringing together all of the points that we found along the way over the last couple of years. I think the story is never over. You know, as long as there's children that are dying, it's important to shed light on that. And even if our work inspires work in other states by other journalists who want to bring attention to this in their communities, I think, you know, it's different in each community depending on how intense the problem is. But we have seen babies dying in pretty much every state, nearly every single state. And until that goes away, I don't think the story completely goes away. We may go on to other topics at some point soon, but I think it'll always be around and we're not opposed to doing additional reporting on it as long as it's still happening.
Yeah, it's important. I love the idea of partnering with a medical organization and doing education because you have all that film. And then you could add so much more recognition of overdoses, red flags to prevent death. So I think you have it all.
Well, thank you. Yes. Well, thanks. Thank you for your help, too, and just giving us information as well. It's important that people are accessible. You know, a lot of times people are busy in their days. You've got a million things you're doing. And so it's really great when people like you make time to help provide information so that people can make decisions.
Yeah. Well, I know that the media is the best way to get important information out. So now I want to pitch you on something. you start out that some of the other reporting that you did was a Lewiston, Maine, and Robert Card, who was the biggest, I think, mass shooting that the state had, 18 people that he killed and injured 13. And there's report that he had mental health behavior, erratic behavior. And I'm wondering if anybody did a toxicology report on Robert Card and what it showed. And I'll tell you why. The database that we're forming is acts of violence and erratic behavior and an association of acts of violence with THC. And sometimes we're seeing that, like, and there's inconsistency in medical examiners. Some medical examiners include THC in everything, like our medical examiner in San Diego, and like right down the street in Los Angeles, they're not. So when we hear weird stories, we always kind of get that autopsy report and see what happens. So there's, and I'd be happy to share that if that interests you. But Michael Blair, 27-year-old who stabbed his 16-month-old, body slam, yelling, "Jesus is coming," acting erratically, heavy odor of marijuana in there in the house, no history of mental health problems, and he had high doses of THC. And that's an example. And an example where medical examiners don't do that is the assassin who tried to kill President Trump, Thomas Crooks. He died. His autopsy was done. It showed no drugs, but like we learned with your pediatric cases, if you don't include things, then it'll show nothing. But it did show high levels of lead. And high levels of lead is associated with people who chronically use marijuana. But they didn't.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Matthew Perry, another example, high profile, right? His autopsy shows ketamine, Suboxone, and the medical examiner even says, well, we added Suboxone because it's additive with ketamine. They never bother with THC. I'm not saying that he had it, but we're trying to advocate that all violent crimes, all traffic fatalities should include THC. Otherwise, you're not going to get this kind of information. So we have a whole series on that. If you want to do a little story, we would be.
It is interesting. It's funny. You may want to check out, I'm not positive about, I do believe there was something done to check into Robert Card. I do not remember just candidly what it said or whether it had anything to do with this, because he did have months of warnings where he had some sort of unusual behavior.
But at a 40-year-old, right? It wasn't like a kid. So a 40-year-old doesn't all of a sudden develop psychosis. It's usually drug. I mean, if it was an 18-year-old.
He also had a diminished hearing. There were lots of different things that were happening that were changing, that his friends and family were noticing about his personality kind of changing and how he would react to things. So I honestly do not remember off the top of my head right now what happened with his medical toxicology report. But I will say, years and years ago, I used to work at Rocky Mountain PBS, the public broadcasting here in Colorado, and I did a series on, it was about this guy named Richard Kirk, who, when the marijuana law first passed, when there weren't a lot of regulations on the dosage and that kind of thing, he had taken, I believe, an edible, and it's been many years because I wasn't planning to talk about this, but he had taken an edible. He ended up killing his wife. And he's in prison. And I ended up doing an interview with him in prison because he kind of maintained that this is not something that he would have done. And, you know, obviously that's not what was found in the court system, and he's serving prison time. But it was an interesting story that I had done a special on. You might be interested. And we ended up doing, I think, a podcast as well. And I could send that to you because we couldn't take a camera into the courtroom. So all you could, I mean, into the prison. So all you could hear is his audio. But it is something that I had looked into in the past, when the law first passed, but I haven't done anything since then.
I totally believe that. We have doing a podcast with Bryn Spacer, and she's there talking, looking like a normal person, went to college, a good upbringing, but she inhaled THC from a bong and ended up stabbing her boyfriend 108 times, killing him, and then stabbing herself. And she would have killed herself if police didn't stop it. And it was just, they tested the bongs and they tested her, and it was just THC.
And the pushback, I mean, especially on the case that I covered, you know, obviously he was found guilty, and, you know, a lot of the people who were on the opposite side, you know, did not believe his story at all. And obviously he's serving time for it. So, you know, it's whether that was never, you know, that's just what he maintained. And
yeah,
you
know, but it depends. I don't know that story, but the phenomenon of having cannabis induced psychosis and I mean, we have video of Bryn, you know, with the knife, and it was, there's no doubt that she killed her boyfriend, but it's not her. It's not her personality. It was altered by drugs. And maybe
it's a fascinating topic. I have not looked into it in many, many years, but, you know, perhaps that's something we could investigate.
Yeah. And then the advocacy, and of course I have like the medical advocacy of it, like I did with fentanyl, like we want fentanyl included in all drug screen. We would hope medical examiners include THC in all violent crimes and traffic fatality. That's kind of our
I mean, case. It is. I do think, just as an investigative reporter, having more data and more information, I'm always an advocate for having as much information as possible. And even when we're telling our stories, it's one thing I say frequently is, you know, oftentimes we get a limited amount of time when we can tell something. And I always want to put as much information in there as I can, because how else are people going to know as much of the whole story unless they have it? So the more information you have, the better. And I think it's always around the corner. You're always being enlightened by something that you have new details that can help you figure out what's going on.
Yeah. So I want to say thank you. Thank you to Scripps News for willing to share all these clips. I'll have links of them in the show notes, and as well as this show. So hopefully people are watching this on video, not just audio, because there's, you know, amazing video. And Lori Jane, you're amazing. Amazing for being so persistent, for being more than an investigative journalist. You're really, you know, doing public health work and education. And I thank you for that. I look forward to staying in touch.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me on and highlighting the work that we've done. And it means a lot to me that I think now the work that we've done will get more ears and eyeballs, hopefully, and hopefully it might save another life.
Yes, yes, yes. Not just through this podcast, but what we do with education.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Drug Free America Foundation. Visit dfaf.org. And ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis. That's IASIC1.org. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths. We'll be right back.